Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days. And good days as well.
Feel like the waterfall of thoughts. And every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala New York Podcast.
And I am Dave, your host, as always. So, you got your compassion, right? That's very spiritual. You got your love, unconditional love, they say. But how does that actually work, right? You ever thought about that? What does that actually look like? If you're really in love with everyone in the world, in New York City, on the subway, is it even possible? Can you have boundaries? Should you have boundaries? What does that mean? Is that a betrayal of unconditional love? So, this is a common question, a great question, a great topic, and today's topic from a talk by Shastri Ethan Nickturn at our weekly Dharma gathering a couple of weeks ago. Shastri Ethan Nickturn, as you know, is a longtime teacher, contributor to the podcast. He is the author of The Road Home, A Contemporary Exploration of the Buddhist Path. He has a new book coming out in September. It's called The Dharma of the Princess Bride. Check it out on Amazon, pre-sale. Go on. You know you want to. Visit us at ny.shambhala.org for all of our upcoming classes and retreats. Our introductory meditation course, which is called Meditation in Everyday Life, is beginning June 1st. The evening course is beginning June 1st. There's a daytime course beginning June 6th. Also this summer, in August, we have another 7-day meditation retreat. Maybe think about what that might be like. You've got a couple months. Yeah, just planting a seed. All the information is on the website, ny.shambhala.org. And now, here is Shastri Ethan Nickturn.
The topic I wanted to cover tonight, just because it comes up so much in my own life and friends and students and related to these teachings, is how we can possibly develop a really expansive sense of compassion, love, unconditionality, and at the same time make good decisions about, as the classic teachings say, knowing what to accept and what to reject. That's in the classic teachings, that's the mark of a truly disciplined student or truly disciplined practitioner, is that they know what to accept and what to reject. So this seems like a really timely topic, like how do we develop compassion and still not support dumb stuff? And I just want to say that the first part, since this talk is called Unconditional Love, Good Boundaries, the first part is, I think, is really the radical part of this, which is the unconditional love part. And this is a very classic idea in a lot of different spiritual traditions, but especially in Buddhism. And it's an idea that scientists and neuroscientists and psychotherapists in the Western world are adopting more and more, that like you can actually train in love. Like you could actually soul cycle for love. I won't make fun of Soul Cycle tonight, don't worry. So that's a powerful idea in and of itself, right? This notion that we could actually expand a capacity. Because if we don't expand our capacity to feel some kind of care or some kind of empathy, sympathy for beings, we're really locked into a very limited view of what the ancient Tibetans called life becomes sort of this dance of what's sometimes called three objects. The objects are categories of sentient beings. So this is a really classic teaching that's related to compassion meditation about how we very simply objectify sentient beings. And the categories are very simple, and they may be very obvious if you have any familiarity with some of the simple frameworks of Buddhism. Friends, that's one category. Enemies. I don't know if you use that sort of kung fu terminology, but those who are against you, and neutral, right? These are the three objects, it's called, within a categorized or compartmentalized view of our relationship to beings. And it's good to have friends. That's a great thing. But it's so interesting how, has anybody noticed how limited it feels to walk onto a subway car and just instantly have your judgments about who your people are? I mean, I think if the typical person had to make the list of friends, enemies, and neutral people, just the way people talk, the friends list would be like this, the enemies list would be like this, and the neutral people would be the biggest list, right? And it feels limited, doesn't it? Or does it feel safe? Or both? Like to know who's for you? Because we don't really know. That's the most interesting thing that happens when a category flips suddenly. We also call that a breakup. So these weirdos in different traditions, but I'm actually thinking of one specific person right now, said, I am going to train, at least mentally, at least in my heart, at least in my own inner space, seeing if I could develop empathy for the people who I think are not for me. There's a very famous story that is mentioned in a lot of places, and I mentioned it in this chapter in The Road Home, of one of the early Tibetan masters who has actually spent some time in what is now Bengal and Indonesia receiving teachings. His name was Atisha, and he was one of the early translators of a lot of Buddhist teachings into Tibet. And the story goes, you may have heard this story, Pema Chodron also tells this story, that he had this very socially difficult assistant who was known as, and I always think of a Wes Anderson movie when I say this, the Bengali tea boy. Have people heard of the tea boy? Sorry. So the tea boy was just who knows what was, you know, going on with this individual, but just like not the kind of person who was there to really help. Was making Atisha and everybody around Atisha's life harder. And Atisha was going to Tibet, which was a harrowing journey in and of itself, but he had heard that Tibetans were super kind. And what he said was, that's not going to be good for my compassion practice. I need to make this a more uphill, I need more of an incline to train with. And so he purposefully against everyone's wishes, brought the Bengali tea boy with him so that he could train. Now, this story works because supposedly the Bengali tea boy was irritating, was annoying, probably was not abusive or outright harmful. So that's one of the things I imagine, that if the Bengali tea boy actually was actively gaslighting or hitting Atisha, he probably wouldn't have kept him on the journey, but he was just irritating. So we could imagine doing that, like, oh, I'm going to work with this person because I have a hard time with them. I mean, could you imagine, what would high school have looked like if this was part of the training? Go hang out with the irritating person, the one who hurts your image a little bit, and force yourself into a more expansive view of reality. Right? The idea here is that we actually want to begin to train in such a way that these three objects, for us, against us, and neutral, friend, enemy, who cares, everybody else, begin to become a little bit more porous, right? That the categories don't have quite the same solidity. Makes a lot of sense, because it's, I mean, it is really nerve-wracking and stressful to walk into every situation and try to figure out who's on your team instantly. It would just be easier to assume everybody's on my team, right? It might be it might lead to more happiness for Atisha. So that's the thing. Atisha, this is the interesting thing about Atisha. He was considered a great bodhisattva, which meant he had dedicated his life to benefiting all beings, which means he was probably trying to think about the tea boy. But at the same time, he was trying to develop a more expansive sense of compassion and care because he saw that these strict categories in his own mind caused a lot of stress. So it's sort of like, who was he trying to help, right? Was he trying to help the T-boy? Was he trying to help himself? Who was he practicing for? Interesting question. I'll save the end of the story because it's funny. So this sets a kind of basis for our practice. Like, wouldn't it be nice to expand? Wouldn't it be nice not to just shrink away from people we disagree with or difficult situations? Wouldn't it definitely be nice to pay attention to the people we don't notice? Never mind the enemies. Wouldn't it be nice to notice people you don't notice on the subway? Here's a good practice for the neutral person on the spot. If you want to do that, may you have happiness. You're on the subway or you're on the street. I guess this could work if you're in a taxi or a Lyft. But whoever your mind is drawn to, wish happiness to the person next to them. That's the practice for the neutral person. And it doesn't mean your mind, by the way, in my humble experience, it doesn't mean your mind is necessarily less interested in the people you take interest in or less irritated or grated a little bit by the people you're averse to. It just means everybody's included a little bit more. So it's a wonderful goal to set. Now, here's the thing. A lot of times, in the name of wishing compassion for everyone, we end up doing things that are helpful to no one. So this is the end of the Atisha story, which people often leave out. He gets to Tibet. he realizes, guess what? Tibetans are people. They're just as annoying as anyone else. So did he have to take on the T-boy on this long and harrowing journey? So just so you know, in Shambhala, just because it's such a interesting, sweet, sort of off-the-wall phrase from the lineage, whenever you're having a workably hard time with someone in your life, at work, in the Sangha or community, at home, in your family, no matter what age they are, no matter what gender they identify with, they're referred to as your T-boy. It's a cute little, right? And if somebody ever says to you in this tradition, you really give me the opportunity to practice, it means you're their T-boy. We talked about passive-aggressive stuff last week when we in class. But how do we handle this? Is everybody, when I felt like there was some agreement in the room when I said in the hopes of doing something that's compassionate towards everyone, we end up doing things that are helpful to no one. Does everybody have experience with this? So there is, I feel like this endemic aspect of well-intentioned things that are not helpful is so part of our cultural, social, political world right now. So just to stop or maybe create a delay before that mushroom cloud enters our discussion, it's just really helpful, I think, to keep this on a personal level. And so Chogyam Trungpa, the founder of our tradition, came up with a phrase, which I think he meant as a loving phrase, for when you claim a compassionate intention, but you do something that's either not helpful or harmful. And he called that phrase idiot compassion. In modern parlance, it could be called enabling, and it could also be called bad boundaries. So idiot compassion, he was a little playful with language. It doesn't mean you're an idiot. It means, or we're an idiot, it means the compassion is idiotic because it does. The compassion doesn't understand. It only understands part of what compassion is. So there's a chapter in The Road Home called The Bodhisattva's Boundaries where I go into sort of four types that have been my favorites of idiot compassion. And they all come from some kind of misunderstanding of an idealized version of what being a bodhisattva or being a loving being or being a decent person or an inclusive person means, right? So that's the first thing I want to say is if you've gotten to idiot compassion, you're on the right track because it's way down the road past greed. Does that make sense? There could be another area of your life where you're still working with the greed thing. Could be the subway seat aspect of your life. Could still be But this conversation is it's a somewhat evolved conversation, so we shouldn't be too judgmental towards ourselves or others because it means we are trying to internalize this notion of being a compassionate being. We're setting that intention, and then there's some, we took a wrong turn somewhere, or we solidified some definition of what a bodhisattva does. And the first version of this is that we think that a bodhisattva puts up with other people's aggressive behavior no matter what. Because a bodhisattva is practicing what in our tradition is often translated as patience, which means a forbearance towards aggression. Which is a great thing to practice. There are so many people in the city with access to car horns who just, it's a very like almost 40 thing to say, somebody who spent most of their life in New York City, but car horns, right? Let's have more idiot compassion when it comes to using our car horn. And so the bodhisattva says, I am never going to be the person to make that noise. And if somebody else makes too much noise or asserts themselves or is aggressive, I'm just like, oh, I'm sorry, right? So I call this doormat compassion. Which is not accommodating anger, it's not patience with anger, it's apologizing for other people's aggression. Which seems a little bit like maybe what the tea boy was bringing out in Atisha, maybe, I don't know, right? And the question here is it actually helpful to apologize for someone else's aggression? Who does that help? So this is the question with curiosity about our idiot compassion, is the question is anybody helped here? And if the answer, it's interesting, because sometimes the answer is one person is helped, the other person isn't, then we have a good bodhisattva discussion on our hands. But if the answer is zero people are helped here, then you have a very clear case of idiot compassion. Right? Does everybody get this? Doormat compassion. The next one I thought of as being popular. Right? Bodhisattvas are popular, right? Right? Like if you're going to be a really compassionate being, everybody knows that in the moment, right? Dr. Martin Luther King, he was super popular in the 1960s, wasn't he? Like as popular as he is right now, right? That's, so if I'm going to be like Dr. King, everybody has to agree with me all the time and say, you're not causing any waves in my samsaric universe. I love you. I mean, go back and do, all the great bodhisattvas in history were pretty unpopular at their time. If they were really manifesting this kind of fearless warriorship that we talk about in this tradition. So that need to, for everybody to say, you're such a compassionate person. This is hard as a teacher, because a lot of times you, there is a lot of bad news in this tradition about the ways we're fooling ourselves. So knowing when to not just make it all good news is hard, right? Every once in a while, we may have to say to somebody we know, like, could you please stop deceiving yourself? It's a tricky moment when you have to make that choice, but I wouldn't do it all the time, for sure. But chances are you're not going to be popular in that moment. So that's the second kind. The third I thought of is the bodhisattva feels like there can't be conflict between other people. Make nice. You tell other people to get along. You guys just, you have to resolve this. This leads to a lot of false equivalences. which is a big dharmic issue in our world. Right? If two people you care about are struggling, are fighting with each other, there can be a wish to make peace, which is a great wish. Who doesn't want peace? Really, who doesn't? I mean, no, I understand that some of us don't want peace in a mosh pit kind of way, but at the end of the day, who doesn't want to feel okay with who they are? But sometimes the conflict is not just like, hey, guys, talk this out, right? Sometimes something needs to come to the surface that's a little bit more painful. And the fourth is a misunderstanding of generosity. Give everything away. I thought this was idiot compassion. I learned this because the three things I decided to do to make a living are be a writer, teach Buddhism, and start a nonprofit. So you have to learn how to profess those things as valuable rather than, oh, whatever, just take it. And so I learned very quickly that when you are, I don't know if you, anybody here who freelances, when somebody asks what your rate is, whatever you say first is the most you are going to possibly get. Expecting anything else is idiot compassion. Does that make sense? So Buddhists need to learn how to negotiate. Otherwise, all the empowerment's going to go to people who are like, thank you, you know. And you'll also learn how idiot compassion works. The phrase I love of, that's not very Buddhist of you. Not always, but 92% of the time, I would say, is being said by somebody who's trying to take advantage of you. So we actually learn to spot, like, oh, okay, there are moments where I idealize generosity, or I idealize patience, or I idealize equanimity among people I care about, or I idealize the pride that a decent being has being known as a bodhisattva. And because of that, I make choices that are based more on perception than actual skillful means. So just noticing this, I think. And if we make friends with our idiot compassion, I think our boundaries get better. I do have to say that when I hear some people talk about the notion of setting boundaries, it often feels very defensive. Do you know, like, I need better boundaries. It almost feels like I need a better fortress. And I totally understand that, because who doesn't want to defend themselves if they've been taken advantage of or hurt? But the kinds of boundaries we're talking about here have more of a quality of really wanting to help. And we're living in a world where a lot of people are arguing that the way to get ahead is to make your heart smaller. Defend more. Attack more. Don't let somebody else make you a doormat. You make them a doormat. And so the unconditional love part, the idea that there are people who are just trying to say, you know what, okay, you might overrun my boundaries, but at least I will have tried to generate more love and compassion. So if you have to make a choice between unconditional love and good boundaries and you don't know which way to go, see if you can err on the side of unconditional love. Even if that means somebody takes advantage of you. There's another ancient Tibetan text on the nature of mind where it says you should make your mind like an empty house. so that if a thief comes, you just let them sit in the empty house for a while with you. Right. So that's the other way to set boundaries, is to realize there's not that much at stake. So we're talking about really wanting to be helpful towards ourselves and others, and that's where boundaries come from. We're not talking about a do you approach. Does that make sense? I mean, do you aesthetically, personality-wise, but when it comes to caring for beings, don't just do you. I have a few more things I could say, but I've done a lot of talking, and Shastri very literally translates as guy who likes to talk, or lady who likes to talk, or one who likes to talk. No, it literally means commentator on the teachings, so that's not that far off. I want to hear from all of you about what we're talking about. Or any of you. Maybe not all of you. Let's set some boundaries.
I just remember hearing Pema give a talk about how she spoke of when she had given a seminar and there was a huge queue of people waiting to mm-hmm. speak with her afterwards. And she was able to really lovingly just say, I must go refill my coffers in order to be of further service.
Mm-hmm.
And it just had an enormous effect on me. I really remember that as to breakthrough in terms of being able to be of service, that one can't without putting on one's own oxygen mask. And it's such a good access and to be able to doing that lovingly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just had a conversation with two other female friends about this the other night, because all three of us are really, like, open-hearted people and want to make people feel comfortable, and we're all for the first time coming out of, like, dancing being our entire lives, working it, like, I'm working at Lululemon, one of them's working as a hostess and one as a waitress, and we've all encountered really interesting experiences with men and being too open-hearted and getting ourselves in kind of dangerous situations in a way of varying degrees. And Molly and I have had this conversation too. So I think it's a really interesting, a really, really necessary thing to bring up because we do want to see the best in people, and we see the best in people first. And being like saying no is actually in so many ways saying no, even just with our body language or whatever it is so much more generous for, like, if we think about, like, not harming sentient beings, because it's stopping that person, at least it's stopping the cycle. So anyways, I just wanted to bring it up from a young female's perspective of how necessary it is to talk about.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I mean, the other way to look at a boundary as a skillful means is it's just, you know, we have stoplights in the city, so fewer people die, you know, or the subway platform has that yellow, it's like, so it's just clear, you know. I mean, boundaries are just about some kind of clarity of perception as well. So, and I do want to honor that there's a big, the doormat aspect of this has a big gender component. So, yeah. Thank you.
I liked what you just said about the mind being an empty house.
Yeah.
That's really a good picture. But
looks like a painting to me.
I'm on hiatus. Is that because the idea would be that because you don't have a hidden agenda and you are truly just trying to, like what she was saying, like keep yourself renewed and able to concentrate on helping other people, but mm-hmm. without being taken advantage of or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Like you're not trying to fill. Yeah, you go.
Yeah, no agenda. I think that's good. Or, I mean, the way I've worked with that notion of no agenda, that's a very ultimate approach to the language. I mean, because who doesn't have an agenda, you know? I mean, Chogyam Trungpa, the guy who said no agenda a lot, he had a schedule. You know, he had a place to be. It's more like if something disrupts whatever course you were on or someone disrupts it, there's no fundamental problem. You weren't needing something to happen. So that's the way I think of that empty house notion. And it's also like you could imagine if your mind was a beautiful empty house and the thief couldn't steal the house, right? So you're fine. It's a feeling of safety. That's the thing, is like we often talk about feeling safe. And our discussion of feeling safe, which is very necessary, is feeling grounded, feeling supported, feeling not threatened, right? And so your reference points or your anchors are very clear. That's a more relative idea of safety. But that text is talking about a more ultimate idea of safety, because if you aren't clinging to any particular anchor, who can mess with you? Now, that's just a glimpse. We don't have to, like, live that. I don't even know what that would mean, living that way. But just to glimpse that, like... And it has something to do... Identity, or the things we cling to, maybe it's always been this way, but in this era, it's becoming more and more virtual. I mean, it could still be physical. Like, if somebody stole an object that you love, there still could be a sense of defense. But I also think that notion of an empty house is just kind of like, be yourself. Be open. But the thing is, in order to do that, we need good boundaries, actually. In order to find the space where we can start to experience that empty house moment, you need to be in a safe house. That's the irony of that.
I'm going to think about that.
Okay.
I'm interested in hearing more about the dynamics of what you meant by the kind of mediator or the get everybody along.
Yeah.
And I'll just say that I'm the fifth of a family of eight kids. So right. I kind of play that role.
Well, I'm going to tell my wife that she's the middle of three. So that, that's the advanced mediation. I think that one has to do with the idiot compassion version of that one. Because wanting people to get along, chances are, you might also be a really good translator of perspectives. Is that true? I mean, is that true?
You mean like being able to...
Like number two and number seven, you know where they're each coming from.
Yes.
You can facilitate a conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's not always productive.
Right.
I really related to when you said that it's not always as simple as just understanding the surface level of each other's perspective. It's a lot of times something deeper needs to come up.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering how to show compassion without it being either unproductive or harmful as wanting to resolve a conflict in a kind of mediator.
Right, right. The way I understand that version of idiot compassion, right, so in this case, it would be us that would be in the idiot compassion position, right? So be the idea of, like, I need to facilitate a compromise here because you two disagreeing makes me uncomfortable. And I can't stand my own discomfort. Therefore, I need to figure out, I need to broker a deal here. Which is very different than the Bodhisattva going into that situation, which is also us, and saying, what is it that really you need to be happy and content? What is it that you really need to be happy and content? Now, here's the problem. A lot of times in our world, the two parties are not clear at all on that. That's a lot of work. That's honestly, that's why right now I have a hard time, and I'll take personal responsibility, understanding the Republican Party. I have no idea what they want. It would be a work, like, what do you want? Then we could start a discussion. And if what you really want, if what number two wants is the destruction of number seven, probably not a good situation to just make nice. Right? Not, hopefully that's not the case in your family.
No comment. Thank you, though.
Yeah. So it's about noticing our own discomfort, the make nice one.
What if you just have really strong startle reflexes and all of a sudden you're like, oh my God, there's all these people are in my house.
Right.
How? No, in your metaphorical house.
Yeah. No, I understand.
Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's great. So what do you do? How do you work with it?
Yeah, like what's the first step aside from imagining an empty house because they've already broken in and you weren't expecting them?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They're comfortable.
Yeah. Well, three things I was going to say about actual actionable practices that we could do to work with idiot compassion. One is, and I have to do this as a teacher because there's just too many, I have a lot of friends, I have a family, and I have to say, like, okay, who can I have in my proverbial house? And so the first thing to do is only respond to requests. So don't go chasing after someone who's not knocking on your door. That's one thing that I have to work with, right? That there has to be some structure where it's like, I mean, I check up on my friends for sure, but if I'm like, oh, I need to help this person, it's like, do I? The second one I was going to say is practice saying no. It's awesome. Or another way to practice saying no is being very clear around what a yes means. Right? Yes, I will do this. No, I won't do that. So those were a couple things I was going to offer. The third is, if there's something that's easy to give, always give it. Now, the startle reflex is going to, I think, is going to make it seem like it's too much. Right? So you may want to, one, have a little bit more space from people at the beginning so that the startle reflex is a little bit less provoked, less triggered, as everybody says now. And you may want to wait for the startle reflex to settle, right? Because sometimes we just get I know this feeling, like a friend who you like says, hey, can we get coffee next week? And you would never tell the friend this, but you receive the email and you're like, oh my God, everybody's asking me for so much. Has anybody ever felt that way? That's my version of the startle. Why is everybody asking me for... a friend just wanted to get coffee with you. That's all that happened there. So I would just learn to make friends with your own startle reflex. Give it a name, a cute name, a friendly name, a basically good name, a Muppet name, Care Bear name, whatever it is for you. All my references are very dated, but I apologize. Dave Chappelle and I talk a lot about the Care Bears, so I'm in good company. Give it a name, and then see what happens after it subsides a little bit. And say, okay, what is being requested? Can I say yes or not? Here's the other thing. A lot of requests are very vague. Because people just want to know you care. And we just want to know people care when we ask for things sometimes. So we're like, can we blah, 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 blah. And it'd be nice to respond to that with, I can X, Y, and Z. How would that be? It's really good to bring things back to specific requests. This is one of the big mistakes the mind makes in dealing with aggression, according to classic Buddhist psychology, is the reason aggression, hatred, irritation can become such a problem is it causes the mind to overgeneralize. It causes the mind to perceive a specific instance as a vague generality and then respond to the entire general case. And so if you find your thoughts are taking the structure of vague generalities, wait. You're in the startle response. And then look for the specific thing that you can practice or the specific thing that you can offer. Is that helpful? But there's probably always something you can offer. Once the startle response, oh, you're like, oh, I could give you this. Now, that might not be enough for them, which is okay. The Bodhisattva can say at that point, I offered something, it was what I could offer. They were looking for something else. I hope they find it. Should we call it a night? Can we just take a moment to wish happiness to yourself and to others, as if both parts of that are equally crucial? May I have happiness. May all beings have happiness. Thank you.
Thank you, Shastri Ethan Nickturn, author of The Road Home and the forthcoming book, The Dharma of the Princess Bride, available for pre-order now. Visit us at ny.chambala.org for all the information about our classes, our weekend retreats, community events. If you happen to live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. Look us up. But if you are in the New York City area, come visit us. Our weekly Dharma gathering is every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. You can hear the talks live and in person, meet the teachers, and it's a good time. And you can email us as well at podcast@shambhalanyc.org. Your questions, comments, suggestions, riddles, whatever you got. Have a very compassionate week.